Hello, and welcome to a Mondays on Tuesdays on Friday. This will be an interesting one. If you're in a good mood, if you're having a good day, this is probably not the best podcast to listen to. If you're in a bad mood, and you're looking for a reason for it, and you'd like to use the rage from the material I'm about to share to turn over a new chapter of your life, this might just be the best thing to listen to because this one will get juicy. I tend to talk shit about a lot of things, but this episode will be an extra lot of shit about things. It's called Racket. That's the subject. And I'm going to talk a bit about Wall Street things and some economy things. And the update from Compare Basic is quite sad. Everything's going on hold again. I spent the morning shutting down servers, downgrading the payroll system because I don't expect payroll to run anytime soon, disabling the crowdfunding. And I'll talk a little bit about the reason why. So some of it is, you know, personal failings of mine, being in research and development mode for a long time, unable to focus on a specific task. Some of it is the climate of the business world, the startup world, and the entrepreneurial world, and I'll talk a bit about that after the music plays. That's one of the reasons this might get a little juicy. But the biggest reason is that the concept that I have always had is some massively powerful technology that can make a big difference in the way interactive software is built and marketed and sold, and also change employment. And what I realized that I was really after turned out to be a system that really sort of reimagines what happened right after the C language. And that's just kind of a bigger sell than I thought I would need to make. I mean, when you sort of say you're changing something at that level, you need something really compelling. And that delayed things a bit. But basically, also what has happened last month is I really have lost motivation. I've got like 1 or 2 hours of good coding until I get overwhelmed, exhausted, I lose my train of thought, or I get a headache. I would say that's about as sad a place as a software project can get to, but I can't say that because the system performs exceptionally well, even exceeding my expectations of how it would perform. The code runs, there's a massive amount of working unit tests. There's about 230 components at this point, all of them work in the symphony in like a wonderful way. So there's still a ton of excitement about the system. And I'm on my way to another job hunt to find some employment that's essentially either a sort of 3-6 month or a year long pause, or, you know, it's a day job. I keep working on it in the background. We'll see depending on what that employment is. But the system is alive and well. Compare Basic is alive and well, even though it'll kind of be on ice. And so I can't say it's the saddest software project I've ever been on because there is tremendous hope in the capability of it. But, you know, the pacing and the timing and the bills that I have stacking up and the inability for it to break through. And I'll talk a bit about that after the break, about what I think the patterns have been historically and what the patterns need to be. The subject matter is going to go over kind of the erosion of small town America in terms of big box stores taking over small things and the consolidation of distribution lines, and then how the acceleration of distribution affected that sort of flattening of opportunity. And then just kind of a bit of sort of what's my perception of as someone who has written, you know, fintech software and has a company, and then, you know, I actually have stock, and I you know, I do the accounting with, you know, the retained earnings and how that works with the assets of the balance sheet. And like, so my perspective on stock is very practical of what it has become and sort of what it could be. And so this will be a bit of a dark episode, but I actually expect it to be a lot of fun, and I expect there to be sort of some hope between the cracks. So if you're in the mood to think deeply about some terrible stuff, bear with me as I flesh it all out after the music plays. So I'll start with one of the things that I've realized as a reason for putting Compare Basic on hold as sort of the largest risk factor I can see is that my perspective on the sort of small business community and the entrepreneurial business community is that it is way behind, and I have found it more or less underwhelming and shallow. I've been involved in three entrepreneurial communities so far in this process. One in London, one in Iowa City, Iowa, one in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And the largest challenge that I see is that there is a severe lack of studying history in terms of what truly changing companies and changing ideas have been over the years, over the decades and years, and a tremendous focus on using something that's already around or focusing almost entirely on marketing something that people already want. And when I look at the big business world, if it is true that it is in fact crumbling, the layoffs tell that story, the volatility tells that story, then this means basically that the small business and entrepreneurial business communities are wholly unprepared to provide alternatives to those companies that are falling out of the sky because they kind of look to me like big corporation light, right? Like it's a bunch of small companies that want to essentially run hypergrowth as if they already have quarterly earnings, and kind of focus heavily on marketing as if they already have a product that people can consume and buy, and to focus on building said products and services, developing said products and services, but also developing said products and services that people don't expect, right? Like filling a need that people don't know they have. That's kind of a gap, in my opinion, in the small business and entrepreneurial community spaces. And so I looked at what it's been like to try and raise awareness for a sort of new way of building software and a new way of talking about software value. And it's just been maddening because everybody wants to see it through the lens of something that already exists. And that means that I need something that really breaks through and really shines and is to such a level of completion that this initial phase, raising awareness and sort of having sort of a donation with a promise of stock behind it process, it's untenable until I have something that really can demonstrate what it does. And when I look at history, I think about things like there was tremendous skepticism and resistance that anyone would want to type on their phone, and the iPhone was not, user tested. It wasn't, hey, do people want this thing that they've never seen before? Because Apple was kind of the first company to bring that multi-touch technology to the world. Before that, touch screens were, really one finger at a time, and that would have made typing impossible. And so it was not realistic for Apple to ask people to imagine a technology they had never had in front of them. It's also a very like sensory, sensitive, subjective thing. People have to use it and see if they like it or not. And so Apple at that time had more or less introduced the world to, in my opinion, kind of every physical usability technology from kind of the Apple OS that originally introduced the pointer, the sort of visual pointer desktop. I mean, supposedly Xerox had it before that, but didn't really market it out to people. And then, tiny little hard drives in the iPod was the first time you had enough songs for it to really compete. And then the multi-touch screen on the phone was when you had a typable screen. And so Apple had this history of releasing really compelling technology, but they kind of did that with an air of not asking for permission. And Dyson Vacuum, I've talked about before, very similar. He built a working prototype out of cardboard. He had the thing working. It was also a commercially viable product in a larger scale in manufacturing to like suck resin or some sort of chemicals out of, this was not technology that was hard to prove. And it still took years and years and years to license it. Harry Potter, the first printing supposedly was 500 copies, and 300 of them ended up at libraries, which is either a brilliant marketing process or it didn't sell. The quality of the book itself didn't sell. It took a long time for The author to get the Scholastic deal in the U.S., which was over $100,000 compared to the 4,000 or so pounds sterling that she got for the original printing. And so you can even look even further back into, Einstein's relativity papers. He must have been talking to everyone he could about what he was working on, yet while his colleagues got, fancy physics jobs, he ended up working in a patent office as kind of like reviewing patents as basically an office grunt, because there was no awareness he was onto something. There was no awareness that the Harry Potter books were going to be as massively successful. If Steve Jobs had gone out and, user tested the touch screens with, something any less usable than a completely functional system, which he would have to build, I think everybody would have said no. Dyson Vacuums also was famous for releasing a transparent dust container, which I think is great. You can see how much dust is in it. But supposedly, I haven't found really good evidence of this. There was user testing that indicated that people didn't want a transparent dust container. They released it anyway, and it was a hit. And so when I look at the actual history of changing technology, there is a long, long history of people not understanding the sort of minds and the efforts of people who are ahead of the curve. And so when I set out to do this and I talk about how, hey, there's a better way to run usability that doesn't involve excessive insights and has much more focus on providing tooling to people to use, and configuration can mean that the parts of your system that change are not necessarily coding tasks, they're configuration tasks. And then I back that up with all of my experience working for all these different companies, doing all of these things, it falls on deaf ears. And either I'm terrible at explaining it, and you be the judge, I just tried and maybe that was terrible, or my assessment of history is somewhat more detailed than the general attitude of the entrepreneurial small business communities that I'm finding, because when I look at the number of things that I love using that really have made a difference in the world and in my life, the lead up was as painful as I'm experiencing. And so I'm not going to get super bitter and complain that nothing's changed, because humans are humans and we evolve at the pace that we do. But it is frustrating that it is hard to find support for this kind of thing. And someone saying, how do we help with people who are trying to see ahead of the curve and provide funding processes and discussion, and look for not what is, but what could be? Because I think that that conversation isn't really happening in a way that I can see, which is, what do people do when they have something that people could use, but they don't know they need it? And as long as that's the case, as long as I feel like history is repeating by not just my ideas, but all of the best ideas being kind of, left to rot on the shelf, then, I'm a take cover with some other employment until I can get something so amazing that I don't have to say, what if, possibly. I can just say, hey, look at this. Look at how cool this thing works. What do you think? Because historically in my career in general, like there's been times when software engineers don't understand each other and they finally just, sit down their respective computers and run the system, look at the code. I mean, we really are a, out of sight, out of mind kind of society. And I don't entirely even know if that should change. I just think that, given that that's where things are, adhering by those rules, time to wait for it to actually exist. And then the other side of this I want to talk about is that the background of businesses consolidating into very, very fixed sort of large conglomerates and, big box stores kind of run the show if you're not plugged in with distributors that get to them. Obviously, that's not important for me in the software space, but the software space does have a sort of bundly challenge where a lot of the office software, a lot of the things you have to connect to or work with are kind of owned by a few players, and people only think of a few companies when they think of them. And I was looking at the history of this earlier this year to try and figure out sort of what I think happened, and I came across the Consumer Pricing Goods Act of 1975. And this is a very interesting point in time, because what this basically did was, before that, like since the Dust Bowl and the Depression, there were a number of laws that were trying to protect consumers, increase competition, increase variety, and build the economy. And what happened here was, President Ford signed into law a bill that basically said, you can't write any law that sets a minimum price for anything. And what had happened was, there were laws on the books in various states. They were kind of conflicting, but they were designed to do this. If a manufacturer says you cannot sell something for lower than a certain price, no retailer was allowed to undercut that below that price. And this sounds odd, right? Why would we want to keep, you know, stores from selling things for a lower price? It doesn't make any sense. Well, basically, the main reason why is that if you're like an independent vitamin company, or if you're an independent hardware store, and a big box store comes into town, and that big box store can make money on their, you know, paint section. If they sell house paint, they can make money selling bicycles. And if they don't really like the hardware store, you know, in town, they can just sell hardware at a loss. And eventually those low prices that they can subsidize with sales from other departments drive that local hardware store out of business. Same thing with the vitamin shop. If the vitamin shop has one vitamin that's like really popular and they like make all their money with it, well, a big box store can just lower the price down to, you know, almost nothing, where they're selling at a loss, and then drive that store out of business. So the reason these protection laws were there was not as a way of indicating that consumers should pay a higher price. It was to protect small merchants from large merchants driving them out of business by selling their same products at a loss and then subsidizing that with the sale of other things. So that happened in 1975. And I at one point had read something that President Ford said, like in the way he was signing it, he said something, and I actually can't find it online now. I'm not sure why. I can see tons and tons of histories of all the sort of history of the actions, but all I can see is like executive action, president signed it into law. So hopefully I can find that and put it in the show notes at some point. But I remember when I read it, he said something to the effect of, these type of pricing protection laws were for another time, or something like that. And I grew up in Fairfield, Iowa in the 90s. And starting from like 1992 to 1996, almost every single store on the town square closed. There was like a gift card place left and like maybe like a pizza place, but really almost all of the shops had closed. And what had happened was, big box stores that came in, you know, out on the highway, you know, a 5 or 10 minute drive away, had really taken away the business from the hardware store and a number of other merchants in town. And when I drove to neighboring towns such as Mount Pleasant, Ottumwa, it was the same thing. You go into the town square and it's just, you know, all boarded up. And so this is one touch point that I think has kind of contributed to the erosion of the small business world that I am now sort of struggling to exist in and find support in. And what this essentially means is that this kind of, however you want to use your money is totally fine approach, has let large companies become wrecking balls for the sort of spaces for small businesses to grow up in. And a lot is discussed about antitrust laws and, well, you don't want to break up monopolies because, you know, people like their monopolies. And let's be honest, we do like our monopolies. I mean, I think if Google was to be broken up, nobody would want to use the second best search engine. And over time, a new leader would be crowned and we would all be using, like, you know, Google 2 or Google 7. You know, like, that's just kind of the reality of our time, is that we do like to get together in groups of people and share the same thing. You know, we want, you're on this thing, so am I. Oh, it's camaraderie. But I think that the answer to making sure that money is earned and not coerced has far more to do with things like minimum price protections or anti-bundling than it has to do with how we traditionally think of monopolies, especially because most large companies are in fact marketplaces at this time. if you look at Amazon, Newegg, eBay, even Walmart.com now, and a bunch of other merchants, they provide the opportunity for other merchants to actually ship things from their location. And so is less a matter of monopoly and more a matter of now it's a marketplace host, and it's a much more complicated thing to figure out what fairness is, because you now have to regulate the conduct of the marketplace. Are they or are they not allowed to deprioritize the search algorithms for a product that was listed somewhere else? Like if this is entirely theoretical, but if Amazon would like to delist a product that was also sold on Walmart.com, or emphasize products that are not on Walmart.com, there isn't a lot of restrictions about that. And so dominance that suppresses quality, it is real, and one of those forms is the bundling. So I for a long time have been very concerned about the idea that if you own the infrastructure and you own the content that you're delivering over that infrastructure, you really don't have to be good at both. if you're the cable company bringing internet to someone's home, you don't have to provide good internet. Or if you provide good internet, you don't have to fix their cable service in time, because they have no other choice. And I think this is really interesting when you think about a functional or a dysfunctional economy, and particularly the opportunities for small businesses, is when you have dominance in sales happening by association, you essentially subject consumers to a vulnerability, which is any individual thing that they consume no longer has to actually earn the sale, because it's bundled with something else. And there was a case in the late 90s against Microsoft where the judge actually said, break them up. They bundled their web browser with their operating system and drove everybody off the road. They can be one or the other. And that was actually that judgment was actually overturned later on by some higher court. It may have gone all the way to the Supreme Court, or it may have just been a court higher than that one that had ruled on it. And when I think about the idea that we've seen so much consolidation over the years, and there's so much endorsement of, be like the big companies because they work, I think a part of it is we have missed this idea that, in my opinion, fake money is money where you don't get your money's worth, and real money is when you get more than your money's worth, so you can in turn make money on the money you've spent. A great meal that gives you a bunch of energy, really satisfying experience you take with you, into a good night's sleep, into a productive day next day, you make a bunch of money. That's like kind of a sort of abstract way of saying you get your money's worth. If that meal is unsatisfying, completely doesn't give you any strength, maybe even makes you sick, costs you your next day at work because you're in a brain fog, or you don't feel well, that's fake money. That money has not given you your value. And if we ever drift into a period where products are being sold not because of what they are and because people elect to buy them, but because of what they're associated with, money shifts severely from the realness to the fakeness side. And the opportunity for small businesses to provide a service on top of something also declines. If you're an innovative ISP, but you don't have a relationship with the cable companies or the fiber companies, it really doesn't matter how innovative your ISP is. You've got no way to connect it. If you're an innovative software company, but you have no connection to the sort of main software system, let's say, can you offer an innovative service that connects to a downstream or upstream system in the event that they just say no, because they would like to bundle that feature into their own thing? This is one of the ways that larger organizations sort of lock out territory without providing quality service. And I actually, in all of my research and all of my time tracing it, I think back to these two things: the Consumer Goods Pricing Act of 1975 and the antitrust lawsuit against Microsoft that was not followed through on. And there's one more really interesting thing to consider, which was these are both times when pricing protection was removed and antitrust was not followed through on. But let's talk about a time when it was followed through on, which was the initial breakup of AT&T Bell in the 50s. And that actually was split off into the Baby Bells. And if you look at what happened in the 60s and 70s, in the telecom industry, the United States created the internet. And there's a really interesting part of this. It's been speculated, and I've seen writings about it a few times, that there was a lot of technology released from AT&T Bell, particularly from Bell Labs, into the public domain at that time. Also, there was a whole bunch of competition between all these baby bells for, telecom supremacy. And soon after inventing the internet, we created cell phones. So it's kind of like you have this massive event in the 50s of breaking up a company that was previously pretty much managing everything too much, I guess. I'm not super familiar with the terms of what they were violating in terms of their monopolisticness, but I do know that Berkeley Systems from Berkeley University was teaching the Unix operating system, and they were all a bunch of their students were hacking on it. A bunch of the professors were teaching it by telling people to hack on it. And there was a huge lawsuit between one of the factions that was the remaining sort of head of one of the remaining AT&T, like I think they were called Baby Bells, and they sued Berkeley University and said you can't publish this because we own it. And this lawsuit basically resulted in the rewriting of a very critical piece of internet technology called the TCP/IP stack. And if you're not familiar with TCP/IP, it's basically this. If the mailman came to your door and gave you a letter, and it was one in a long series, and then it came to you and says, here's page two, here's page three, here's page four. If you're keeping track of it and any of them are missing, you can send another message that says, hey, I missed page two. Hey, I missed page one. And this back and forth confirmation process is responsible for something we've all seen written about our Wi-Fi, which is packet loss. Packet loss literally is when a packet in the series is missed or dropped and requested again. And there are some slowdowns from this. It's about to be replaced in HTTP/3 with the QUIC protocol, which merges it with some of the parity checking and cryptography from TLS, which was previously called SSH, which we all know by typing HTTPS into our browser. So there's a lot of things about this, but the TCP/IP stack, in my opinion, is the single reason the internet works, has worked until now, and now that we have something to replace it with, it could get even better. But it is the only reason your Wi-Fi works. It is the only reason the internet has survived, and that was actually created in part by the breakup of AT&T and Bell and all of those things around it. And so I think when we look at periods of enormous wealth in the United States, and I believe that that breakup of a monopoly led to the sort of the golden age of technology and telecom contributions that America has to the world. And then you look at the Consumer Goods Pricing Act of 1975 that basically stopped companies from having any restriction on how they basically just, undercut their neighbors. And then you look at the restriction on bundling software together and sort of using infrastructure as a reason to force whatever product you have as a sidecar to it. You look at the failure to those two things in 1975 in the late 1990s, and then you look at the lack of interesting things that that the United States has contributed in the sort of 30 to 50 years after that. And I think we can make a pretty compelling case that the enforcement of antitrust laws is a pretty good thing, and that the United States has gone kind of scorched earth on protecting companies that don't innovate while sort of eradicating the environment and opportunities for companies that would like to. And to round this out with one more thing is the idea of how attitudes on Wall Street have kind of shaped business culture. And I had an experience because, because I'm living my best broke life, I liquidated my 401k last year. And when I sold the stock, it didn't go into my bank account. It went into the account of the investment firm. And I then transferred it to my bank account. And I've seen this pattern on Wall Street a lot lately, especially this year and last year, where the stock will dip. The stock price in general, if you look at like the S&P 500, like SPDY index, it will dip significantly, and then the next day, it'll come back. And I don't know this for sure. There's no way to know this for sure, but I wonder if the experience of the traders is that they see the money leave the market and come into the investment account, And they look at it. They think, well, if I transfer this out to my clients, maybe I am one of the clients. If I transfer this out to myself, the racket's over. The show's up. You know, there's no more market to play in if that happens. And then they got to find another occupation, and you know, they would have to do something else with their life. And I kind of wonder if the money leaves the market because there's some circumstance of some kind that makes people think everything's going to fall down. And then they look at all that money in the investment account and they're like, do I take it, leave, find something else to do with my life? Or do we put it back? Let's keep the show going. And I if I'm right about that, it's somewhat humorous, but somewhat interesting, this idea that people really want to keep doing what they're doing. And I think that mentality may actually have really a lot to do with why it is such a challenge to sell things and talk to people about things that are somewhat ahead of the curve, is that there seems to be so much motivation to keep doing things the way they're going, even at times in the face of them not really working. We've had a big transition, or at least discussion of a transition, from resume-based hiring to skills-based hiring. I haven't really seen any strategies for what is replacing the resume and how people are describing their skills. And the thing I'm the most important in is whether or not skills that are not acquired in a professional setting are admissible. Things you've learned from a sports team you were part of, or from raising your kids, or from a volunteer project you had. And I think that the reason for some of the economic challenges we have, and the reason it's so hard to pivot, is there's such an overcommitment to a certain industry across many, many years, qualifying you for the next step in that career. And I think when I think of those traders, if it is in fact true that they look at that amount of money and they realize that if they don't put it back into the market, they won't have an occupation. I wonder if a lot of the sort of lockout in small entrepreneurial companies that I'm experiencing is because there is a keep the conventions going in big business, even if they're not necessarily serving you. And so people come from big businesses and they say, oh, I'm going to go, you know, help people start businesses. And they come in with the same advice of market something that already exists and that kind of thing. And so while I am very excited about what I have learned, I'm very excited about the Seneca technology. I'm definitely heartbroken by putting this thing on ice again. If you would like to see sort of what I have been working on up to this point, there is information at comparebasic.com. I'll continue releasing these podcasts and see how things go. And, you know, wish me luck as I, you know, set sail back out into the economy of existing work. And I'll see you next week.